Now, this is what had happened to the Buddha, you know, in spades. You know, he practiced with all his heart and mind. He died with respect to the ordinary mind. He awakened to the real nature of mind. He fully, completely arrived in this existence in a way no one had ever done before. And there are quite a few different stories told in the scriptures about what happened. I think we might have heard some last night, but I wasn't there. Mara trying to scare the Buddha. Mara's daughters trying to seduce the Buddha. The earth goddess bearing witness to his efforts. This is all around the enlightenment, the Buddha's enlightenment. The great god, Big G, in Indian mythology called Brahma Sahampati, asking him to teach. And also the giant serpent, Michelinda, wrapping him in his coils, wrapping him with his body. And these stories may seem hyperbolic. They might seem rather too much to believe. And that's because over 2,500 years odd, the amazing events that actually happened became legend. They became cartoon-like versions of what happened. But I think we love this kind of thing. We love stories of superheroes, super baddies like Mara, and giants like the Incredible Hulk, who isn't in the Pali canon. But these stories give us a way to think and reflect about things on a deep level of our minds, to take them in somehow quite deeply. Anyway, the story that really sums up today's theme of absorption is something that we're told happened 3 weeks after the Buddha's Great Awakening. He was sitting under this big tree, meditating. It was daytime, but the sky started getting darker. The sun became hidden by clouds, which became darker and darker, blacker and blacker, and it grew. First it got cool, a bit cool, and then it just got really cold. Really quite cold, and there was obviously an enormous storm brewing up. And it was going to be a storm bigger than any of the animals in the forest could remember. The birds stopped singing, and they got into their nests or under whatever shelter they could find. Every mammal, every reptile went to its home. Even the tiny insects, they got deep inside their tiny holes and crevices, or they found themselves some kind of covering, or maybe it was a leaf or a stone. They needed to do that. So as the cold deepened and the darkness gathered, it became strangely quiet. The Buddha just carried on meditating, of course. You know, he was completely absorbed in his realization. He was aware of all that was happening, but he was aware in the way of the Tathagatas, the Buddhas who dwell in the true nature of things. But I tell you, the silence in those woods just before the storm was profound. It was awe-inspiringly quiet. And then for a few moments, you couldn't work out what the sound was, but suddenly you realized it was the very finest first pattering of raindrops. And the sound got gradually more pronounced, and then, yes, it was clearly raining. You know that feeling when you're in a tent and it sort of just starts raining. Yes, it is raining, isn't it? It was like that. It's clearly raining, and suddenly you could smell the dust as the first drops started hitting the dry ground. And the raindrops got bigger and bigger and heavier and heavier. And it was just a minute or two before it was really chucking it down. It was really, really chucking it down. The rain was streaming down, bucketing down. Great sheets of rain were coming down. And then, at that point, then came the wind. The wind howling and screaming through the dense undergrowth and just lashing the rain against the tree where the Buddha was sitting, still meditating. It became even darker, and even almost as dark as night, and just at the point where it was blackest, across the treetops there came streaking bolts of lightning and deafening crashes of thunder. And the animals and the birds and the insects, they really got dug in and they covered their ears. And the Buddha, of course, was fine with all this. For him, it wasn't some kind of spiritual test. This wasn't Mara up to his tricks. It was just nature. It was just the elements. Earth, water, temperature, and wind. The same as those that made up his body. The great elements were just doing what came naturally to them. Yes, he was going to get soaked to the skin. Yes, it was cold and noisy and it was all moving about quite a lot. But, hey, you know, he was okay. He was enlightened, after all. So he just continued sitting, as calm and concentrated as he was, before the storm started. But then something new happened. All of a sudden, out of the base of the tree, there slid a very large and very long and very green snake. It was so large and so long, extremely long, just want to emphasize that point, that it seemed almost impossibly enormous. The serpent was considerably bigger than the Buddha. It wasn't that, you know. Anyway, considerably bigger than the Buddha. He was shiny in his scales. He was a beautiful deep green colour with red and gold markings. He was so impressive. So who was this? It was Muchalinda, the king of the serpents, the Naga king. It was an enormous cobra with a gigantic hood, intense red snaky eyes, and a forked tongue that flickered between his fangs constantly, like little pink flashes of lightning. And this being, this wonderful being, looked at the Buddha. The Buddha didn't say anything. He wasn't hissing. The snake wasn't hissing. The Buddha also looked at the big snake. They just looked at one another. And somehow they both knew what was about to happen. And then it happened. It happened. The Naga drew himself right up close to the Buddha. And he started winding his body around the body of the Buddha. He was taking care. He wasn't trying to constrict the Buddha. He was just wrapping himself. And he wrapped himself around the Buddha at least three times, quite gently. And finally, completely covering him, completely insulating him from the weather, which was definitely going on outside him. And then he unfurled his great hood overhead even more and stood protecting him. And the Buddha just continued, of course, sitting there inside what was now almost a kind of tent, carrying on with his meditation. And the storm raged all that night with no let up. Thunder and lightning came again and again. The rain and the wind lashed the forest constantly. And it wasn't long before the ground became completely waterlogged. And in fact, the storm continued for that whole week, a whole week before it started dying down. And all that time, the Buddha remained quite motionless, quite relaxed in his meditation, perfectly relaxed. And it was the same with the Naga king. They're both completely relaxed about this. So that's how the story goes. That's the legend. That's the image. Rather strange image. And we have to try to understand what actually happened. Because something certainly happened. And it may have something to do with the energy of awakening. The energy of awakening. There's a lot of energy aroused when you see a snake. At the best of times, most people find snakes unsettling. I mean, and a direct encounter can be downright terrifying. So to me, this great Naga, so powerful and bizarrely coiling himself and protecting the Buddha, suggests the hidden strength of nature, that like the form of the snake, is unsettling and not easy to handle. It's that aspect of nature, that aspect of experience. It's also there in the great storm, in the elements going a bit wild. And here that wild energy is welling up, it's overflowing, and then joining forces with the Buddha's enlightened energy as a vital part of his enlightenment experience. And sometimes, as a yogic experience, this is called Chandali or Kundalini. The coiled-up serpent unfolds its coils. Because enlightenment is a transformation, not only of the conscious mind, but of the whole mind. The mind that includes the whole physical, even evolutionary process. It wasn't just his mind that became awakened. His body awakened as well. This is a great mystery, the body. Our experience of physical matter is something really mysterious. The elemental forces and functions of nature that usually happen quite unconsciously, spontaneously, now became awake in the Buddha's mind. And they became powers and sensibilities of understanding which could support his efforts as a teacher, as a bodhisattva. I mean, later on, as a teacher, the Buddha introduced the practices that nowadays still work to cultivate the awakening he experienced. The ethical practices, meditation practices, and wisdom practices. All of them informed by the special experience that happened with Mucchalinda. All Buddhist methods cultivate this connection with the subtle energies, the natural forces of mind and body. Because this is something subtle, we can't talk about it much. But we can see it when we look at our experience in terms of energy. All experience has an energy equivalent. I remember Bhante once reformulated the five precepts in terms of energy. Because when we're being truthful, being kind and helpful to others, not acting in violent ways, this also connects with and aligns with the subtle energies of nature. Ethical behaviour harmonises our relationship with others and with the whole natural world. You can feel the difference. This is what I'm talking about. You can feel the difference physically, tangibly. And the practice itself awakens the sensitivity that enables you to feel that. And once ethical sensibility is awakened, you can feel it when it's not there as well. You know, at least you can for a while until you lose it again. You can feel the harshness, the insensitivity, the jarring quality when you're unkind. You can feel it for a while until you lose it. And where you feel it is in the subtle elements, in the subtle energies and physical awareness that come from mindful Dharma practice. You feel it in your bones and you feel it in your water. And we are all involved with these energy processes, and in many ways, there's no mystery about it. We just don't have many words for it. Whenever you feel that disharmony, you can know directly that there's an ethical issue to be tackled. And in meditation, one is working with these energies. Indeed, the reason insight experiences happen, the reason why they are so transformative, is because there takes place a profound shift in the prana, or the subtle energy, in the body and in the mind. So Mucchalinda's surrounding the Buddha with his body communicates all this. He shows how the connection works between this world of nature and the Dharma, the truth the Buddha discovered. You can say that his teaching of ethics, meditation, and wisdom are none other than the cultivation practice of deep nature, or even, to sound a more contemporary note, deep ecology. And the science of ecology strives in a similar way to understand all the relationships between all species at all levels, in a similar way to how Buddhism has an overview of all existence. Ecology develops its own big picture of all life systems. Of course, this has now become very influential and bound up with very urgent political and social issues. So people often try to square Buddhism with these issues. And it seems a vitally important bridge to make. We need perhaps to be a bit careful about that we do justice to the fullness of the Buddhist vision. But it seems to me that Buddhist practices quite naturally cultivate ecological values. Dharma practice promotes harmony and understanding, not just between all humans, but between all species. Buddhism doesn't really differentiate between species. It speaks to all beings, and its teaching is not limited to human beings. Obviously, beings have very different capacities, including mental capacities, and humans do seem to be special, right? But humans do also vary quite a lot. And then many animals have ethical sensibilities, so there's a certain potential for them, both for spiritual growth and also spiritual deterioration. So animals do sometimes practice the Dharma. And this is quite well documented in Buddhist literature. In one of the scriptural accounts of the Buddha's meeting with the Naga king, Muchalinda afterwards becomes a follower of the Buddha and practices his teaching. That's one example. I once attended a retreat with a Tibetan Lama, who at one point he asked us all to go out and teach what we'd learned to the animals living around the retreat site, which resulted in some quite humorous sights. As you went out on a walk and you see other retreatants discoursing or trying to discourse, some kind of discourse with birds, farm animals, and even with insects. And the Lama was in the tradition of Milarepa, who is also said to have helped animals to achieve definite degrees of awakening. The Buddha himself taught his followers to cultivate loving kindness to non-human beings as well as humans. In fact, there's one record in the scriptures of him teaching a specific Metta-bhavana meditation to all the different species, all the different families of snakes. And I think the Muchalinda episode of the Buddha's enlightenment experience offers us some very important advice. There's more to nature. There's indeed quite a lot of people answering the calls of nature at the moment. There's more to life itself than we tend to think. Even the Buddha needed to learn this. Even the Buddha, who's brought up in a traditional society and who'd spent pretty much all his time after leaving home outdoors, he still had a lot more to learn about nature. And meeting Muchalinda, I think, was an important turning point for him. Somewhere, realizing the ultimate nature of reality must involve insight into the nature of nature. And that must involve a certain quality of contact with nature. I admire traditional cultures which in the past have cultivated a very deep awareness of the animal and vegetable life, because it obviously gives them a perspective on the value of human life. I think of, probably you think as well, of Native American traditions, just to give one example. They see so many inspiring qualities in animals and plants, and as humans, it keeps them balanced. Knowing that, it keeps them from becoming too proud and too complacent. And to know directly the vulnerability of both humans and non-humans keeps alive a keener sense of ethics, of what it really means to be kind. Of course, right now in our human history, we're realizing how far, collectively, we've moved away from nature. There are many ways we can change. I think we just need to be open to there being much, much more to discover. There's enormous depth, I think, beneath the shiny surfaces of our what's become a very neat and shiny and box-like world. I think realizing this depth is an aspect of Buddhist practice. On the one hand, we need to let go our over-solid, rather fixed ideas of what nature is. It's very important. While on the other hand, letting go any unreal or sentimental feelings about it. We need to find somehow a new and dynamic way of realizing our connection with nature. And I don't think we've done that yet. In one of his very earliest teachings, just to sum up a bit, the Buddha spoke about a snake casting off its old skin, casting aside its old skin. He's probably still thinking about Mucchalinda. Some of us might be rather envious of this quite amazing attribute that snakes have. But actually there's no need, because we can all do a version of what they do. From time to time, if you don't, maybe you don't know this, from time to time in a snake's life, there's some rather intense sort of wriggling, and all of the old, wrinkly, crusty body surface just splits, it just drops away, and underneath there's a completely new skin. Amazing. It's like having a new body, a new life, and off goes this new snake. And that's what the Buddha meant. He was saying that from time to time we need to do that intense wriggle. That intense wriggle. We need to split off our old skin and burst free of the past and emerge and be reborn as a shiny, shimmering new beast. And then off we go. Our whole civilization needs to do this, actually. I mean, right now as a culture, we know nature from experience less and less, even though, ironically, we know more and more about its workings from external observation. It isn't just that the effects of our alienation is stripping the planet of its resources and killing it and impoverishing the lives of all its living beings, all of them. That's certainly very bad. But if that were all, it would not be special as an issue for Buddhists. After all, Buddhism is about liberation from all conditionings, the most essential conditionings being in our mind. Of course, we need to be kind towards all these suffering beings. But beyond that, it's nothing new that beings are harming other beings. That's just samsara. I think it's for this reason that you can sometimes get a rather kind of so what feeling from Buddhists when you mention the ecological crisis. So what? This is typical of human nature. It's just samsara. Just more samsara. And this is quite true. It's kind of true, but a point we Buddhists should take note of is that as a culture, we seem to be losing awareness of our own nature. And that creates a particular kind of obstacle to liberation. The main reason I feel we need nature is because contact with it gives essential clues about who we really are. It offers a much needed balance. Sangharakshita once said that for Buddhism to take root in the West, it must somehow incorporate the ancient pagan pre-Christian wisdom. And this is why. It's because of what we can call the Mucchalinda factor. We need to recognize more clearly our connection to the earth and the other elements of water, fire, and wind. The quality, the subtlety and power of that connection, and incorporate it in all the many ways we practice the Dharma. Thank you.